Good afternoon. Thank you all for coming out this afternoon. I appreciate you taking time out of your Sunday afternoon to come out and spend some time looking at the human side of Henry Clay. Glad you all did that. It's always a pleasure and an honor to get to speak at the library. I spend a lot of time at the library. On fines alone, I've probably subsidized a fair portion of the library. This is actually my home library. This happens to be between Ashland, where I work, and where I live, so I drive by this library lots of times. So it's good to be here. It's nice to be in this library. My name is Eric Brooks. I am the curator at Ashland, the Henry Clay Estate, which basically means I take care of the stuff, and if there's a question, I'm the one they call to answer it. And if something is wrong, you know, if there's a question of fact that is wrong, that's usually on me. But anyway, so today we're going to talk about Sins as Thick as Mice, The Vices of Henry Clay. We're going to look at the human side of Henry Clay, who he was, things that he got criticized for by his opponents. And if you think that that sort of behavior is new, it is not at all. And it was every bit as rough then as it is now. They didn't have TV or computers or Facebook or some of those things, which perhaps is an improvement, but they certainly used every available platform to criticize each other and the parties, their various candidates. So we're going to look at that, and through doing it, we're going to gain a greater understanding of Henry Clay, the man, who he really was. And even Henry Clay acknowledged that these things that we're going to talk about were things that he did and things that, in many cases, he probably should not have done. So he was aware of that, understood that, and when it came time, tried to ensure that his sons, grandsons, etc., did not follow in his footsteps, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So Henry Clay was a very private man, or was a private individual, had a private estate, but by virtue of being a political figure, of being an attorney, etc., chose to live in a very public sphere. That was his option. He could have done differently, but he was happy with that. That was okay with them. He liked people, and he didn't mind being among them, and accepted the price for that being a relative lack of privacy as compared to the average person. Of course, his visage was very well known, so it wasn't like he could really hide, but he didn't choose to try to do so at any event. And this is kind of what that looked like. This particular picture, we have a reproduction of at Ashland. It is entitled The Illustrious Guest. And in this particular image, Henry Clay has arrived at a tavern, put down his luggage, sat down by the fire to warm up, picked up the local paper to see what's going on in the world, and everybody in the tavern is paying attention to him, as you can see. They're looking at him. That's fine by me. I got a computer, so I can work with it. There you go. Okay. So, as I was saying, you can see he's surrounded by people. They're all looking at him. There are two guys looking at the guest book. They're checking out his signature. There are actually two signatures in the guest book that you can see. One of them is Henry Clay's. The other is that of the artist. That's how he chose to sign this painting, which I think was an interesting approach to take. But basically, they're all checking Clay out, and that's what happened when he went places. People would stop what they were doing to see him, to pay attention to him, wanted to know him, etc. So that was the life that he led. And of course, that meant that everything that he did was held up to scrutiny and was done in a way that everybody knew about it. He paid a price for that. Now, the title of the presentation comes from a critical song. Henry Clay was often known as the old coon. He was portrayed sometimes as a raccoon, an image that goes back to his predecessor, or previous, the 1840 campaign with William Henry Harrison. He was portrayed as kind of a backwoodsman living in a cabin with a raccoon. That's where the old coon comes from. Clay used it a great deal. It was a symbol often associated with him, with his party, the Whig Party. This particular song, as I say, was composed by one of his critics. Some curious people accused him of vice. A little tricky to see in the dark. Sorry. Why is this not? Yeah, that's why. It said that his sins were thicker than mice. But the scrupulous dogs were rather too nice to complain that he loved a pair of dice. They bring out Blue Law Frelinghuysen and think that he is a trump card to play, but his morals soon will be perverted if company he keeps with old Clay. And Frelinghuysen was his running mate in 1844. And I'll talk more about what that really means as we get on into the presentation. But that's where the title comes from. So they're saying he has all of these sins, and make special mention to gambling, which we'll talk about, and that even Frelinghuysen would become perverted if he spent much time around Henry Clay. So, warm with wine. Henry Clay was often accused of being a drunk. I don't know that he was a drunk, but he certainly drank. There is no question of that. If you look at the receipts in the papers, there's liberal reference to alcoholic beverages, which he consumed a great deal of. And he consumed a great many. Madeira, port, sangria, sherry, a variety of wines. He had a wine cellar in the basement at Ashland. He occasionally enjoyed a beer. And, of course, he was a Kentuckian, and like most Kentuckians, enjoyed a bourbon. And that was fine. I mean, he did that. He enjoyed doing that, but it never seemed to affect his work. He could go out, get off, you know, finish work at the end of the day, go to the tavern or the restaurant or whatever, have a meal, have drink, and do that into the wee hours of the night, go to bed, get up the next morning, and do it all again. A fact that was frustrating to some of his colleagues, John Quincy Adams, for example, when Henry Clay was negotiating the Treaty of Ghent. He was one of five Americans sent to do that. John Quincy Adams was one of the others. John Quincy Adams is possibly the least fun individual of Henry Clay's era. He seemed to be allergic to fun. Having fun was just not something you should be doing. He would get up very early in the morning, 4:30, 5 o'clock, to read the Bible and begin work for his day. And Henry Clay would be strolling in from his night of fun and go to bed. And at 9 or 10 o'clock, they would meet at the negotiating table, and he just couldn't fathom how anyone could do that. And it just really irked him that someone should be able to do that. So anyway, Clay did, and it didn't seem to affect his ability to perform. Now, there were times when there were consequences. There's a good example of a story in which Henry Clay went to an event, served at a very long dining table. There were a number of courses, and each course had a different beverage that went with it. And by the end of the night, Henry Clay was feeling pretty good. So he jumped up on the table and danced his way down it, sending silverware and china and everything flying in all directions, which was a great delight to Henry Clay and to those around him. Well, he went to bed, and the next morning he got up to check out of the hotel. Hotel manager presents him with a bill for several hundred dollars for all of the tableware that he had sent flying. Henry Clay paid it and said, "That's fine. The price of having a good time." So didn't seem to bother him, but that was the sort of thing that he sometimes got into. Those are Henry Clay's sherry decanters. Those are on exhibit at Ashland. There is at least one other set of a similar nature that is engraved in that way for Henry Clay. We also have a number of other decanters at Ashland that are said to have been his that do not have specific markings to identify them. If I could get the lights up, I do have a few artifacts, so periodically I'm going to need to have the lights up to make that part of the presentation work. So we're going to start with a couple of alcohol-related artifacts. For many years, the James E. Pepper Distillery produced Old Henry Clay whiskey in the 1920s. We actually have a bottle in the collection from that era, one of the early bottles. I don't know exactly when they stopped producing, but it was quite some time ago, and the distillery sat vacant for a long time until very recently. Somebody went in, renovated, cleaned it up, and they're now producing alcohol again under the name James E. Pepper, including Old Henry Clay whiskey. So that's the modern version. People often ask me, how do you collect your artifacts? And there are a variety of answers to that question. There are not a lot of things that I won't do in collecting an artifact. In this particular case, that I got out of the trash can at our annual fundraiser. So you can find artifacts anywhere if you're willing to look. This particular artifact comes from Washington, D.C. It is made by a local craft brewery. It is called D.C. Brow. That's the label. This particular beer is an India Pale called The Corruption, which is a good name for an alcoholic beverage in Washington. They put little factoids on their containers, so as you're enjoying your beverage, you can learn a little something in the process. This particular factoid is about the 1824 presidential campaign. It talks about the corrupt bargain in which Henry Clay supposedly stole the election from Andrew Jackson in a deal with John Quincy Adams, in which Adams became president, Henry Clay became Secretary of State. That election had been in the House of Representatives. That was not really what happened. Clay was going to vote for Adams in any event, but nonetheless, another marketing piece using Henry Clay to sell an alcoholic beverage, and there are other examples. These are two that we have in the collection. This particular example, I was alerted to by a Henry Clay descendant who had gone to D.C. and had it, and so I called the brewery up and said, I'd like to have some cans. And they said, well, we can't ship you full ones. I said, that's okay. I don't really want a full can of beer in my collection. So they sent me a whole six-pack that had never been filled, so they're empty. Got to like that. That worked out very well. It was also a lot lighter to ship than a full collection of beer cans. We mentioned gambling. Gambling was something that Clay did often, something he did in a variety of ways. He would bet on virtually anything and enjoyed the process of it. He liked the thrill of it. Would bet on horse racing, any number of games. For example, we have a ledger. There is a ledger at UK that he kept in his home. And we can see that on several occasions, he played billiards and bet on billiards. We actually have a billiard table at Ashland. It's not his. It belonged to his grandson-in-law. But nonetheless, he bet on billiards. And we know from at least one receipt that on one particular day, Clay won 4 silk waistcoats playing billiards. He never says whether they were being worn at the time. We don't know how that worked. And it seems a little odd to think that guys were just carrying around spare clothing for the purpose of betting. But maybe it was one of those things that he won, and the guy said, don't worry, I'll make good on that. And they went to the tailor later. I don't know. It also would, you know, make it challenging unless you were happening to be betting against someone your exact size to make that really work. But nonetheless, we know he won silk waistcoats. The game that he played most often was cards. Brag, whist, there were several games. This is a card that was made shortly after Henry Clay died. The backside features a medallion that was made for Henry Clay by some citizens of the city of New York. So this was a commemorative item made after he died in his memory. And these are how cards looked during that era. They didn't have letters or numbers on them as cards do today, so you had to really know your cards to know what card was what, or at least be able to count in the case of the ones with numerical values. So that is a typical card of the sort that Henry Clay might have used in playing cards. And he was very good at it. His wife was once asked if she was concerned with the fact that he gambled so much, and she said, heavens no, he almost always wins, which is true. Almost always is not always. He did lose from time to time. And more often than not, when he lost, he was able to find ways around that. He either won it back later or convinced whoever he lost to, usually a friend or a colleague, to let the debt go. Whatever the case, he rarely was totally out of pocket as a result of gambling or amassed major gambling debts, although he certainly could have. Henry Clay was a man accused of being godless, of not being a religious sort, and relatively speaking, that was true. Henry Clay was not a very religious man, but then men in general were not expected to be religious in his time. Religion was sort of the province of women. It was expected that women would go to church regularly and use religion as a tool to instill morality, etc., in their children. Men were, it was just assumed, not going to do that. Not going to engage in that on a regular basis, and Clay did not. Clay saw himself as a man of politics, therefore he did not or could not or should not engage in religion if he wasn't going to do so in a meaningful way. So he did not, over most of his life, go to church on a regular basis, although he owned a pew at Christ Church Episcopal, where his wife went. Eventually, he came to a point in his life where he found a need for and desire to be much more religious, and that happened in 1847. There were several things that happened at that time to push him in that direction. He lost his son Henry Jr. in the Mexican War. Henry was the 7th of the 11 children that he and his wife had that they buried. They had already buried all of their daughters. Now they buried Henry Jr. So that was quite a loss for them. And that pushed Henry Clay to a point that he had seen his wife rely upon her religion as a means of getting through times of that sort. And so he decided that it was time for him, likewise, to turn to religion to get through this most recent loss. The other thing was, By 1847, Henry Clay was 70 years old, and at that point in his life, he figured he had lived a good long life, but, you know, needed to get right with God before life came to an end. So he went ahead, he was baptized. This book is his Book of Common Prayer that was used at his baptism. You see here that it is inscribed. This particular book was a gift prior to being used at Henry Clay's baptism. It had been used by President-elect William Henry Harrison at a church in Pittsburgh. This was later used for some of Henry Clay's descendants to be baptized and is in the collection at Ashland. I didn't bring it because it's a very, very important item, but I did bring another item. If I can get the lights again, please. Thank you. This is also a Book of Common Prayer from our collection. This particular Book of Common Prayer, Henry Clay received on Christmas Day of 1849. It's inscribed thusly. If you look up at the top, the following March, 1850, Henry Clay re-gifts it to someone else. Now, I don't know what she thought. I mean, it was already inscribed, so it wasn't like he could hide the fact of when and how he got it. So I don't know what she thought of that. But I guess he figured, I already have one Book of Common Prayer. That's probably sufficient, since they're all pretty much the same. That's another one from our collection. This next section of the presentation is in many ways the most difficult to do from a variety of perspectives. The evidence requires a lot of thought and interpretation. It also goes into some areas that are really difficult and in some ways reminiscent of things that are happening today. So it's interesting to look at this particular aspect of Henry Clay's life. Clay was accused of having affairs with white women or being a womanizer. It is true that he was very popular with women, particularly intelligent women. He liked conversation with intelligent women, enjoyed the company of intelligent women. Women were a big part of his political life. He was a Whig, and the Whig Party allowed women to have a very large role in political matters, even though they couldn't vote. So he enjoyed the support of women a great deal. There is no substantial evidence to indicate that he ever had an affair with a white woman. So I don't think that holds a lot of water. Could he have? Yeah, sure. He was in Washington, D.C. a great deal of time when Lucretia was not, and there would have been, I'm sure, other opportunities. Did he? Like I say, I have no evidence to suggest that, in fact, he did. That said, however, there is another sort of intimate relation for which the evidence is different. That is the sexual exploitation of enslaved women. Henry Clay enslaved a great many people at any given time, 20 to 50, and probably close to 100 over the course of his life. It's reasonable to think that a goodly percentage of those, I don't know if it was 50%, but probably 30, 40% or something, were female. And so that possibility always existed. And it is something that men who enslaved women often did. I mean, there's plenty of evidence for others who have done it. Thomas Jefferson, Richard Minter Johnson from Scott County, Kentucky, who became Vice President of the United States. So it certainly did happen. And with respect to Henry Clay, we can start with this particular piece of evidence. This is a newspaper article. This particular newspaper article was first published in the New Orleans Times-Picayune. It was picked up and later published nationwide in papers around the country. This was published in about 1894. This particular article is a story about an enslaved woman, now by this time a free woman, by the name of Phoebe Moore. Indicates that Phoebe was enslaved at Ashland, that she had originally been enslaved by Thomas Hart Benton, who was a political colleague and distant relative of Clay's wife, that Clay met her when she was in her mid-teens and became infatuated with her and essentially acquired her from Thomas Hart Benton, and that he exploited her thereafter. And it goes on to say that eventually he emancipated her. She went on, married another man around the time of the Civil War. They had some children, and she died in 1894, or thereabouts, when this article came out. It indicates that she kept her emancipation papers her entire life, and that she had other letters from Henry Clay that he wrote after her emancipation, in sort of a continuance of this exploitation. I have never been able to locate a record that would definitively show this woman being enslaved at Ashland. Could have happened. Some of our records are not entirely clear. Often, for example, we don't have a last name. We just have a first name. And so it might be difficult to be sure. The other thing about this story is that it's printed in the paper, and I don't know how the paper got hold of it. Obviously, she had passed on, so she wasn't delivering it directly, nor do I know exactly why. What is the motivation for printing this at this time? I think probably the papers picked it up because it was sensational, and it was about a well-known public figure, and so papers then, or like papers now, they were looking to print things that would sell, and this was something that would sell. So that in and of itself is not a tremendous amount of evidence in this regard. However, there is another document that I have recently discovered that is in the Filson Historical Society in Louisville. This is a letter. This letter was written in 1844. The gentleman that is writing the letter has just bought a farm in Mississippi. And he's writing to his brother who lives in, I think, Connecticut, something like that. These are just two ordinary guys. They're not of any particular note. They're not famous. They're not political figures. They're just two guys. And the guy that has set up his farm in Mississippi writes about farm life and what's going on in that area of Mississippi. And then he turns a bit to politics. This was during the campaign of 1844, Henry Clay's, in some ways, greatest presidential campaign, the one he came the closest to winning. So this is at a point where he's the candidate, and there's going to be an election in the near future, and they're discussing candidates. And these two gentlemen were apparently Democrats, as best as I can gather from the letter. They don't expressly state that, but the way they talk about Henry Clay and the way that they talk about the election, I think they were, which would be the opposing party to Henry Clay. But the one guy, the guy in Mississippi writing the letter, tells a story that he has heard. He's talking about Clay and the fact that other gentlemen have openly sort of had these sorts of exploitations. Clay has never been open about any such thing, but he's saying, I've heard this story, which indicates he's doing it as well. And the story he tells is that Henry Clay had enslaved a woman whose primary purpose, primary job, was taking care of the chickens. She took care of the chicken coop, and she lived in a dwelling nearby. Well, what we know about the domestic core of the estate is that the mansion where it is located today was near a chicken coop, those kinds of structures which were serving that area. I mean, the chickens were being raised primarily for food and to produce eggs for the family. So that's where that would have been. Just a little ways from that was a series of slave quarters that ran alongside what is today the formal garden. And she probably would have lived in that area. So that sort of fits. That jibes with what we know about the estate. It says that Henry Clay took a liking to her and engaged in one of these exploitive relationships. And that at some point Lucretia went to find them one day. And they weren't in the chicken coop. So she went down to this woman's dwelling and found Henry Clay there. And what the letter says is that he was ministering to this woman more lovingly even than he did to Lucretia, which obviously did not sit well with Lucretia. She became very angry. She insisted that Henry Clay sell the woman and her children, which he did, sold them down south. The writer of this letter indicates that he has seen several of these children and that it is his belief that they are Henry Clay's children. There's not much doubt of that. He cites, the man writing the letter cites as his source for this story, the overseer at the time. And this apparently happened about 4 years before the letter was written. That would make the overseer a man named Albert Floria. We know that Albert Floria was hired in 1837, that he worked at Ashland until about 1844. He apparently acquired a farm of his own and left to work his own farm and died a very short time later at a very young age. I've recently learned of and visited his burial place, which is in Jessamine County. I have no way to confirm whether he ever knew of or told such a story. Albert Floria was not a famous man. There is not a lot in the way of correspondence or other documentation of his life. Like I say, I do know some of his descendants, and there are sort of the kind, you know, census records and those kinds of things that indicate where he lived and maybe what he did. But as far as verifying the story from that end, that does not seem at present to be a possibility. That said, this source is not a source that's being written for any particular purpose other than discussion between these two individuals. They have no reason to believe this information will become known otherwise. The one individual is citing a source that would have had the potential to know. So we have to take that a little more seriously, I think. Bottom line is this. We don't know for sure whether Henry Clay engaged in this sort of exploitation, but we do know that he had enslaved women and that he certainly could have. So This is something that could have very easily occurred, and we have to think seriously about that and accept that possibility. One of the more well-known vices, I guess you would say, of Henry Clay was that of dueling. Like many of the gentlemen of the South, Henry Clay believed in the code of honor and the idea that if you made statements about someone, you should be prepared to put your life behind those statements. And twice he challenged men to do that. This is a pair of dueling pistols that we have at Ashland that are in our collection. These were used by, or brought by Henry Clay to his first duel. I don't believe he ever used them there. As he was the challenger in both cases, the challenged party would have had choice of weapons and would have almost certainly selected their own. Later on, after the duel, Henry Clay borrowed these. He borrowed them from a man named William Lord Morton. Morton Middle School is named for him. He was the deputy sheriff of Fayette County and a big businessman. I guess if you're going to borrow weapons to do violence, best to borrow them from law enforcement. So Henry Clay returned the pistols, and later on, when Morton died, Morton left them in his will to Henry Clay, and they've been in the family and then at Ashland ever since. So Henry Clay fought two duels. The first one was with this gentleman, a man named Humphrey Marshall, who, at least based on that expression, doesn't exactly look like, I don't know, the happiest fellow or maybe the most easygoing fellow. That's Henry Clay about that time. That's the earliest known image of Henry, actually. This particular argument was over homespun clothing. Henry Clay believed that as Americans, the Kentucky legislators, and he was a Kentucky legislator at this time in 1809, that they should wear homespun clothing rather than clothing made from imported fabrics. Humphrey Marshall would have none of that. Wasn't going to happen. He was going to wear his imported silks and wools and whatever. And they got into a big fight on the floor of the state legislature over this matter. Eventually, a very large man who happened to be a fellow legislator grabbed them around the head and said, "That's enough, I'll whip you both," which settled it down. So the next day, Henry Clay sends that note to Humphrey Marshall saying, "I demand satisfaction." Humphrey Marshall writes back later that same day, "Very well, you shall have it." Notice that Henry Clay scribbled a few things out, so when Marshall wrote back, he made sure to do likewise. So everybody was being equal here. So they decided to have a duel, and on January the 19th of 1809, they did exactly that. Now, this duel took place in Indiana, just across the river from Louisville. They didn't want to violate Kentucky state law, so they went to Indiana, which was at the time a territory and therefore had no state law to violate. So they go to a clearing in southern Indiana and have a duel. On Henry Clay's first shot, he makes a slight wound to the belly of Humphrey Marshall, grazes his belly, minor injury, the duel goes on. Humphrey Marshall, miss. Second shot, a snap. Now I'm going to need the lights again to explain that. So that is a dueling pistol. Don't worry, it is neither loaded nor would it shoot if it were. In fact, if you like this particular pistol, it's currently available in our museum store, would be if when I bring it back. It's $76.95. I think it's currently on sale for about like $58. So you can get it in the museum store. You can probably get a second one, and you and your friends could have your own duel or a Masudo duel. Anyway, this is a flintlock. This is what Henry used in his first duel. The pistols as they exist today at Ashland have been converted to percussion caps. The way a flintlock works, you cock the hammer, which contains a little piece of flint. When you pull the trigger, the hammer strikes this. This is called the frizzen. When it strikes the frizzen, it creates a spark, lighting the powder in this little thing called the pan. There's a hole inside the pan that admits that spark to the chamber, which lights the charge, firing the projectile. Now, these weapons were relatively unreliable. Probably one out of every five or six shots snapped, which meant that the powder here might have lit, but it didn't light the powder on the inside. That's a snap, also known as a flash in the pan. That is where that expression comes from. That's what happened to Henry Clay. In the rules of dueling, that's just too bad. No shot for you. So Henry Clay's second shot doesn't go anywhere. Then Humphrey Marshall fires his second, miss. So No more harm done. Third shot, Henry Clay misses. Third shot for Humphrey Marshall. He hits Henry Clay in the leg. A very minor wound. Doesn't break bone. Kind of grazes the leg. But it does cause Henry Clay to have a minor limp for the rest of his life. Not a terribly noticeable one. It didn't affect him in his ability to do things. But it does remind him, I suppose, of this particular duel. Now, after the third shots were fired, Henry Clay became very angry. He had had a snap, and therefore another shot was warranted. His second pulled him aside and said, "Henry, you lived. You have had two misses and got lucky on a third. Let's not do this again." So they eventually settled matters, shook hands, and went away. Henry Clay would have another duel against that man. That man's name is John Randolph. John Randolph was from a very wealthy, very old, very important family in Virginia. They had a huge plantation on which he lived. His statement about that was that it had had two owners, the Randolphs and God. Randolph also suffered an unusual medical condition. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but the effect of this condition was that for all practical purposes, he did not go through puberty or exhibit secondary sexual characteristics, facial hair, changing of voice, that sort of thing. And I think it probably affected him, or at least the effect of having not having these changes and being different caused him to be rather irascible, someone who was willing to do whatever he wanted to do. Nobody was going to tell him different. He had a temper. And everybody knew that about Randolph. That was no surprise. That's Henry. Henry was Speaker of the House when Randolph was in the House. Randolph had a habit. He had two hunting dogs, which he was very fond of, and he would bring them to the House and sit them next to his chair in the House. Well, that didn't go over with Henry Clay or a number of other people in the House. I thought that was just totally disrespectful that he would bring his dogs into this body. Well, they tried a number of times to stop it and couldn't seem to find a way to do it. But Henry Clay eventually came up with a solution to this problem. It happened that the two dogs were both female. So eventually, one day, Randolph brought them to the House. And Henry Clay said, "Now, Mr. Randolph, you know as well as I do that the rules of the House stipulate that no females are allowed on the floor. So those dogs have to go." And Randolph sputtered and became angry. The sergeant-at-arms came out and said, "I'm sorry, I'm going to have to remove these females from our floor." And he does, and takes the dogs out. And that's the last time the dogs were brought to the House. That was one of many things that sort of agitated Randolph about Henry Clay. He and Clay were opposed on a variety of topics. He was one that believed that in 1824, the presidential election that year was thrown into the House because none of the four candidates received an electoral majority. So it went to the House, and the top three candidates were voted on by the House. Henry Clay finished fourth, but he was Speaker. So to some extent, he became kingmaker, and John Quincy Adams won in the House, although Andrew Jackson was the leading popular vote getter prior to going to the House. And Jackson, of course, assumed this was a result of a corrupt bargain between Adams and Clay, in which Clay became Secretary of State, which was the position at that time viewed as the springboard to the presidency. And certainly Randolph held that view. Well, by 1826, Clay has moved on to the role of Secretary of State. Randolph is newly installed in the Senate. And conversation occurs in the Senate about an idea that Adams and Clay have about sending American representatives to Panama to a conference of American nations across the Americas that would look at economics and trade and that kind of thing. And Randolph thinks this is a really bad idea. He doesn't think we should be involved in that sort of thing, and makes a speech on the floor of the Senate about it, in which he calls Henry Clay, calls John Randolph, or John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay, Blilfil and Black George. Those are characters from Henry James's novel, The Turn of the Screw, which if you'd like to have it, probably is available here at the library. Nonetheless, Blilfil is a man who is outwardly very pious, but is inwardly eaten up with jealousy. Black George was a card sharp, a cheat. So he's saying Henry Clay is a cheat. Well, Henry Clay wasn't even in the Senate at the time, so he couldn't respond. So Henry Clay sends a challenge to Randolph. It challenges him to a duel. Randolph accepts. So April 8th, 1826, John Randolph, sitting United States Senator, and Henry Clay, sitting United States Secretary of State, get in a rowboat, go across the Potomac to the location of an intersection that is today in the city of Arlington, and they fight a duel. So when you think about politics today, think about the fact that these two men were shooting at each other over their disagreement. So pretty incredible stuff. So we got our scoreboard here. Henry Clay, John Randolph. First shot, no surprise. Sorry, it's a little hard to see up here. Miss. Henry Clay was not a good shot. If you haven't figured that out by now, he was a terrible, terrible shot. John Randolph missed, which is surprising because Randolph was an excellent shot. Well-known hunter, well-known marksman, someone who had done this before, and so the fact that Henry Clay was doing it was really not wise. Now, on the second shot, Clay again missed, but he got close. Randolph was wearing a very large, billowy black coat, and the bullet went through the coat, piercing it and making a hole in it. On Randolph's second shot, he raises his pistol into the air, fires straight up in the air to end the duel. Randolph had decided before this duel was ever fought that he was not going to deprive Lucretia of her husband, nor Clay's children of their father, nor the country of the services of this great statesman. So he intentionally brings the duel to a close with his shot in the air. The two men come together, they shake hands. Randolph says to Clay, "You, sir, owe me a coat." And Clay says to Randolph, "I'm glad the debt is not greater." And so the matter was closed, and they went on with their lives, luckily for Henry Clay. So, as I said previously, Clay was criticized heavily for his activities. That's a political cartoon. This is also from our collection. In this particular cartoon, Clay is the man with the devil on his back. The devil and Clay are sort of colluding. The devil is saying, "Don't worry, everything's fine. You've got this gentleman to protect you. You can see he's got a dueling pistol stuck in his waistband. There are some cards and dueling pistols around him." So all these symbols of the things that he's doing. This man is reading a book, seemingly oblivious to all that's going on, while the crowd is hurling sticks and stones. And they are labeled dueling, drinking, gambling, and cursing. So what this is talking about is Theodore Frelinghuysen, who is the man in the large robe. He's wearing that because at the time, he was the president of a university. So that's an academic robe. Now, Frelinghuysen was selected to be Henry Clay's running mate in 1844. The reason for that was that he didn't duel, drink, gamble, or curse. And the thinking was, well, if you don't like that about Clay, it's all right. We've got a guy for you. That'll work. He's a very puritanical, very religious man. He doesn't do all those things, which was all true. Unfortunately, however, he was also very much a Protestant and very anti-Catholic. So they lost all these Catholic votes, and that more than offset whatever they might have gained as a result of his seeming purity versus Henry Clay's seeming corruption. And that's what they're talking about in the song that we looked at the beginning. The idea that if Frelinghuysen hangs out with Clay long enough, he too is going to be debased by all these activities. Well, that never happened. Also, this did not succeed. Clay was not elected president in this year. So didn't work out in the way that they had hoped. Clay knew, as I said previously, what he was doing. He knew the potential consequences of what he is doing. He knew and learned the hard way how things could go and go very, very wrong. And so he worked very hard to explain to his sons and grandsons, don't do as I do, do as I say. Don't fall to dissipation. Don't drink. Don't gamble. Don't do all these things. You know, don't duel. Those things are not good. You can be very seriously hurt by them. And this is a letter he wrote to his grandson, Andrew Eugene Irwin, and he's explaining all of this. Now, don't let yourself fall into these traps, particularly gambling. If you fall into a trap with gambling, you can lose a lot and find yourself in a very bad way. And not only does Clay appeal to Irwin based on his own experience, he also mentions Eugene's brother, James. James lived in New Orleans. He was an inveterate gambler and got so far behind in debt that eventually he went into his hotel room, put a gun in his mouth, and killed himself. So he has an example that he can use to teach Eugene. And certainly any number of Clay's descendants had issues of this sort. Alcohol was an issue for a number of them. Gambling was an issue for some. So they engaged in some of these behaviors, whether Henry Clay counseled them one way or another. But Henry Clay, like I say, knew what he was doing, knew the reality of his behavior, and wanted to do what he could to try to help his sons avoid the pitfalls that he had seen. So I'll open the floor up for some questions.
Yes. I'm curious, the last letter that you showed that he wrote to his grandson.
Yes.
The lines are perfectly straight. Did they do that freehand, or did they have some sort of writing?
Some people did use rulers or whatever, but writing was something that was taught at a very early age, and a lot of time was spent creating penmanship and teaching people to write in a way that was very neat and legible. It had to be done. I mean, there was no typewriter. Certainly weren't any computers, so the only way one could express oneself to another over distance was through handwriting. And so you had to learn to write in a way that could be read by someone far away, and perhaps someone who had never seen your own handwriting before. And many people wrote very, very well. Looking at letters that I've looked at, doing research, an awful lot of them are exquisitely beautiful. Now, there are some folks whose handwriting was absolutely terrible. And there are a few people. Henry Clay's son James is very hard to read, for example. So it varied, but that was a skill that was very highly taught and very highly thought of. A lot of effort put into learning penmanship.
When did he go back to the silk waistcoats? When did Henry Clay go back to the silk waistcoats?
Well, I don't think he waited very long after that. I'm not sure he really ever left totally. That was, a thing in the lead up to the War of 1812. So once the War of 1812 was over, there was really no reason to worry about that. We had fought a war with the British. We had established a treaty that brought about status quo antebellum and sort of held them to a draw. So we no longer really needed to worry about whether we were importing or not. Now, Clay still advocated very strongly for American goods and for tariffs to make those goods more affordable, etc. And certainly would have sought out American silks or wools or other fabrics that were of good quality, but it ceased to be a significant political issue after the War of 1812.
On that first duel, where you had the copies of Henry Clay's challenge,
right?
How did you get that copy?
Those I found online. That's been a while. I want to say they're at the Library of Congress. I know I found them. There are several sources for things like that as well that have gathered documents and images and whatnot and provide them for these kinds of purposes. So it's been a while since I've acquired those, but I think they were like maybe Library of Congress. Yes, ma'am. So, first question, when was the house built? Well, it was built more than once. Henry Clay acquired his first 125 acres in 1804. In 1805, he signs a contract for brick. Now, we're not sure exactly what happens in that era. There are some sources that would tell you there was a house already there, which might have meant he was renovating or augmenting it. There are others that indicate there wasn't. I don't know. What I do know is this. Lucretia was a city girl. She never wanted to live in the country, or at least didn't set out that way. So I'm sure she would have encouraged Henry Clay heavily to bring the house to a certain standard in order to move out there from the city. So we think that they were residing there about 1807 or so and expanded it to its full five-part federal form. We know that happened in about 1813. Benjamin Latrobe did a plan in 1813 to add the wings. And the house stood in that configuration until Henry Clay died. He died in 1852, and his son inherited, or acquired, purchased, really, from the estate, the property, including the mansion and the frontage on Richmond Road, and found the mansion to be in a state of significant disrepair. So he tore it down to the foundation and rebuilt to create a monument to his father, for which he was relatively heavily criticized. But nonetheless, that's the mansion that we have today. It was modified by Henry Clay's granddaughter and grandson-in-law in the 1880s. And what we have now is an amalgam of all of these forms. Now, as far as the slave question goes, Henry Clay, as I said earlier, probably at any given time would have enslaved about 50 people, something like that. And we right now have documentation of about 100, I think, that he enslaved during his life. And there may be more than that that we don't yet have documentation for. Henry Clay enslaved a lot of people, But as compared to some of the plantations of the Deep South, for example, that number was not nearly so large.
What was his relationship with Mary Todd?
With Mary Todd? Todd, yes. So the Todds lived in town. Mary's father, Robert, owned a store, was a Whig. Henry Clay and Robert knew each other well, were friends. Henry Clay did business occasionally with the Todds. Mary grew up knowing that and grew up knowing Henry Clay. She describes herself in youth as a fiery little Whig. So she was clearly a Henry Clay fan and supporter, definitely an admirer of Clay. There's a great story about her riding out to the estate. She was educated at the Mantell School, which is on the other side of Richmond Road, down a little towards town. But she rode her pony over to the estate one day, knocked on the front door, basically insisted that Clay come out. They talked about the fact that he was running for president, and she hoped that if he won, that she could visit him at the White House, and sort of expressed a young girl's crush on Henry Clay, I guess you would say. So she clearly admired and respected him a great deal. And I think one of the reasons that she was so attracted to Lincoln was that Lincoln, A, reminded her of Clay. Very tall, gangly kind of man like Henry Clay was. He was an avid Clay supporter, saw Clay as the political ideal. So in some ways she was able to find her crush, if you will, through Lincoln. I think she probably also had some influence on Lincoln in keeping him a Clay supporter. But nonetheless, she was definitely a friend and admirer of Henry Clay's. Yes, Charlie. So, right, yeah, Clay returned to Washington for the last time in the fall of 1851, and by that time had been suffering tuberculosis probably for several years. If you look at the letters and things, he's got a cough, he's not feeling well, and that's going on for a long time. But he never seems to be able to admit to himself that he's got TB, and he's got an illness that will ultimately be fatal. I think when he went back, he knew deep down inside this was it. I mean, he was getting to the end, and he actually announced his resignation. It was to be effective in August of 1852. And I think he thought perhaps he could make it long enough to make it back home at that point. He probably would have preferred to die at Ashland in some ways. Although, on the other side of it, I think dying in Washington meant he could die feeling to the end like he was doing something or like, you know, he was keeping on. So I think, you know, he knew pretty well. And it didn't take very long after he got there, I think, for his health to deteriorate to a point that he knew he was not going any further. I mean, I think he, by February or March, he was reasonably certain he was not going home again. So he was a very sick man, and I think he went knowing that, hoping, like I say, perhaps to get one final go and get back home. And it didn't work out. He was too sick.
When did dueling?
The last duel fought in Kentucky, I believe, was fought in 1864 or 5, along about the Civil War. I don't think you hear about it much after the Civil War. It was predominantly an antebellum activity. Certainly the violence of the Civil War may have had something to do with that. People may have just plain had enough of that. I don't know. The other thing is that after the Civil War, by the Civil War, weapons had evolved in ways that dueling would have been significantly more dangerous. When you're dealing with flintlocks, you're dealing with weapons that don't always function very well, as I indicated, you know, pretty regularly these things misfire. Plus, they're smoothbore, which means there's no grooves, no rifling, so the bullet doesn't spin. So it's much harder to hit anything with that. When you get to a revolver, for example, that is rifled, that has the grooves, that's a much more accurate, much more dangerous weapon. And I suspect at a certain point, weapons got to a point of effectiveness that dueling just simply became a pointless exercise. Everybody who did it was going to die. So, you know, if you're standing 20 paces apart, that's 60 feet. That's roughly from the end of that table to perhaps the end of that, or you know, width of this room, something like that, maybe a little further. With any weapon of any accuracy, not going to end well. So I think by the Civil War, it was simply no longer a practical thing. Goes.
Were Henry Clay's sins, gambling, and drinking, and perhaps other sins, pretty common to his class?
Yes. as a member of the upper class of society, as a white man, particularly in the South, things like dueling, gambling, and drinking were de rigueur. Everybody did that. In fact, there were many who did it to far greater degree than Henry Clay. Henry Clay was often criticized as a very violent, bloodthirsty man. Well, take him in comparison to, say, Andrew Jackson, who not only fought multiple duels, more duels than Henry Clay, for sure, he fought them at times at very close range, rolling around on the ground, wrestling with his opponent. I mean, he was willing to get up close and personal and kill, and it didn't bother him at all. And in fact, he carried a bullet in his upper chest from doing that. So comparatively speaking, Henry Clay wasn't necessarily as bad or as violent or whatever as others of his ilk. Yes. Right. He had 11 children. Of the five daughters, three died in childhood, either in the six daughters, rather. Four died in childhood or adolescence. Two survived to adulthood. But they both died as young women. One died of yellow fever. The other died of the effects of childbirth. The one that died of yellow fever had given birth not long before, so that may have had an impact. But they all died relatively young. Of the six daughters, only one has descendants today, Henry Clay's daughter Anne. Her son Eugene had children with his wife Josephine. They have descendants. There may be descendants from at least one other son. I'm not dead sure. There was at one time. I don't know whether that line continues today. Of the sons, Henry Clay had five sons. One son, Theodore, suffered from mental illness. We aren't exactly sure what that entailed. There is some evidence to suggest perhaps that that was a familial thing. There is also a family story that he was injured as a child, he was about 10, and suffered a head injury. And to relieve the pressure on his brain, they trephined him. Trephining is a medical procedure that was practiced, in fact, it's still practiced to some extent, in which a section of the skull is removed to alleviate pressure on the brain and reduce swelling of the brain. And that the trephining that he underwent may have resulted in later psychological consequences. But he spent the majority of his adult life in what is now the Eastern State Hospital as a result of his mental condition. The other sons did relatively well for themselves. Henry Jr. Engaged in a variety of businesses, went to West Point. He was killed at the Battle of Buena Vista in the Mexican War. He was a graduate of West Point. So he died in battle, a great loss to Henry Clay, the loss of his namesake, the son in which he invested the greatest hope in the future. Thomas went into the hemp business with his father. That was an up-and-down business, but he did well enough. He married one of the Mintels. They live at a house that still stands. The house next door to Shriners Hospital, it's kind of back behind all those trees, is the home in which they live. That's called Mansfield. Henry Clay's son, James, married a very wealthy young lady from Louisville. Her father was one of the first millionaires in Kentucky, a man named John I. Jacob. They, of course, occupied Ashland. He engaged in a variety of activities, farming, law, politics, served a term in the House. Seemed to have great difficulty sticking to anything. Whatever he did it for a little while and then moved on. I don't know why, that just seemed to be his personality. They have descendants that survive. Thomas has descendants that survive. Henry Clay's youngest child, John, built a house on the other side of the property over near Christ the King. There's a church, an Anglican church across the street. That Anglican church was at one time Chevy Chase Baptist. They bought John's house long after John died and used it for Sunday school and things until the 1960s. Then they tore it down and put in a parking lot, so that's where he lived. He was a very, very successful horseman. He married Josephine Russell Irwin Clay. She had been married to Henry Clay's grandson, Eugene. He was killed in the Civil War. She was a Confederate widow living in Missouri, which was controlled by the Union. She needed a place to go and a way to protect her family, so she was invited to come back to Lexington. She became John's housekeeper. They married in 1866. She took over the horse business when he died and ran it very, very successfully. Her daughters all married. One died not long after marrying. The other two had children, and they still have descendants, many descendants today. So, John never had children of his own, but he raised Eugene's as his own. Took good care of them. Yes?
Where did he live in D.C.?
When Henry Clay was in D.C.? Well, he lived at several places. When he was Secretary of State, for at least the second half of that tenure, he lived at Decatur House, which is on Lafayette Square across from the White House. He rented that building, lived in it during that period. During a good part of his Senate career, he lived at a place called the National Hotel, and that's where he died, room 32. And the National Hotel is located near the museum. You may be familiar with that edifice. It's up kind of between the White House and the Capitol. Charlie, do you remember exactly where that was located?
I think right where the museum is.
Yeah, right.
If you go up on the second level of that,
right.
You would be right where Henry Clay died.
Right. He lived in room 32 on the second floor of that building. But he lived in a number of other boarding houses at various times. Lucretia went with him until 1835, and so they would have had probably larger or more commodious dwellings than after that. Like many, he was by himself, so he shared quarters with others. Or had a hotel room. When he died, in the last few years of his life at the National Hotel, he had a room that was a bedroom and a parlor. So it was a fairly, sizable area that he had, or living space that he had. And he took his meals in the dining room there. And probably, towards the end, had the meals brought up to his room. But that's where he lived. Lucretia was actually born in Hagerstown, Maryland. Her family was originally from, I think, North Carolina, moved to Maryland. She was from there. They came to Lexington in 1795. She would have been about 14 when they arrived. So she was relatively grown at that point. Henry Clay and Lucretia married in 1799. She was 18 when they married. They were married for 53 years, had 11 children. Lucretia is someone that is somewhat enigmatic. There is very, very little in the way of her own writing to draw a picture of her. For whatever reason, almost none of her letters survive. There are two or three that are known. And from what Henry Clay says, by probably 1830 or 35, she stopped writing altogether. He indicates that it pained her, so perhaps she had arthritis in her hands or something similar. But she didn't write after that. We know from accounts of friends and relatives that she was a person who preferred taking care of her home, taking care of her children. They would go in Washington, for example, there might be an event going on. She'd be sitting in the back working on needlework with her kids around her. That was the kind of person Lucretia was. During this period, women were expected to maintain a domestic role. They were expected to remain in the home, to raise the children, be the arbiters of morality, to submit to and support their husbands. And she did that very, very well. She threw events for Henry Clay. She had events for Henry Clay at Ashland a great many times and when she was in D.C. In fact, while he was Secretary of State, she alternated with Dolly Madison having a weekly party. And those parties were really important because they provided an opportunity for individuals to get together, politicians to get together, and sort of work out problems and do business in an informal environment with the aid and assistance of libation, et cetera, so that when they went back onto the floor of the legislature, rather than having to discuss and debate it all, they already had some idea of what they could work out and what they could do. So a very important part of Henry Clay's career was what Lucretia did for him in dealing with and handling these sorts of responsibilities. Yes?
I know they were married.
Yes.
Did they live with them after they were married? Or did
they lived, yes. When they were married, they lived for a short time with her father. Then they built a house next door. Unfortunately, that whole section of 2nd Street is a parking lot now. Not even a good one. It's terrible. It's a gravel lot. I don't even know, we'll do something with it. But yes, those two houses no longer stand. In fact, the Bluegrass Trust exists because the Hart home was torn down. And they didn't want to see that happen any further. The Hunt Morgan House was being threatened. So they formed to protect homes like that from being torn down.
Were congressmen paid during the
Yes,
time?
They were paid. They were not paid, I would say, on an equivalent level as they are now, for sure. It was not an occupation through which one could necessarily make a complete living. In fact, Henry Clay resigned from or left the legislature on more than one occasion to come home, practice law, and or farm in order to replenish his coffers. So it was not a road necessarily to become wealthy, but they did pay And it might have been a road through which you could gain exposure, acquaintance, etc., that might ultimately have led you to other ventures, other businesses in which you could become wealthy. So they were paid. Yes, ma'am.
Did he own racehorses?
Oh, yes. Henry Clay was quite the breeder of thoroughbreds. He had two prize mares, Magnolia and Margaret Wood. They have female tail lines in the female side, through which 11 Kentucky Derby winners trace. Almost every year we have an entrant from those horses. This past year we did not. It was the first year in a good while. We were 0-for on those, I think both the Derby and the Oaks, actually. We usually have at least one in each. And if you want to know, I usually post that information on our website. So I make no guarantees. Do what you wish with it at your own risk. Nonetheless, we've not had a winner since 1982 and 83. Sonny Salo and Gato del Sol won back-to-back derbies, and that's the last time we've had a winner. So I've been at Ashland 17 and a half years, and every year I say, yeah, maybe this year will be the year. No, you know, I'm going to, at this rate, we may not get one in my time. I don't know. But anyway, yes, he was very, very successful as a horse breeder and racer. Yes.
This is a question about the new sculpture.
Okay. Right.
What's the story behind that?
So those sculptures are by an artist named John Henry, who is a Lexington artist, grew up here. He is currently based in Chattanooga. I'm not sure where all he's been based. Never been exhibited in Lexington before. So they represent an opportunity to consider the grounds in a new way, perhaps consider Henry Clay in a new way. You can look at them and see elements of compromise and balance, which are important themes in Henry Clay's life. If you look at the one in the front of the house, you can see elements of things coming apart or the chaos in which Henry Clay lived. He lived in an era where things constantly were on the verge of collapse. And he fought very hard to keep things moving forward and avoid that collapse. So what we're trying to do is provide an opportunity, a lens, as a new way to look at the estate and look at Henry Clay. We are creating a new grounds tour, which will debut on August 3rd, which will incorporate the art that's on the grounds, and that, not just the three metal sculptures, but Maggio Missouri, which is the horse, that's out on Richmond Road. Of course, we had lots of horses at Ashland, so that makes a lot of sense. It's a very pretty sculpture. We also have a guy who's done a number of wattle pieces for us, wattle fencing, which is sticks woven. It's a very old form of fencing. Henry Clay might have had some wattle fencing on his farm. It's working really well to keep our hemp in place, so we like that. But he's did a little small wattle sculpture up by the cottage, mostly to fill in a spot to avoid people parking on it. But it's a really neat little sculpture, like a little, sort of a basket or container, if you will. Yes.
Do you have time to tell the story of Amos Kendall?
Amos Kendall? I can at least, I don't know that I have enough of the story to hand to tell a lot of it, but Amos Kendall was the tutor for Henry Clay's children in the 1810s, I guess, from, 1805 to 1820 or something like that. Amos Kendall was kind of an interesting character. He wrote autobiography, and he talks a lot about working at Ashland. And if he is to be believed, Henry Clay's sons, at least, must have been real terrors. They did some really wild things. And that's quite possible. I mean, I think it's quite reasonable to believe they may have been difficult to handle, for sure. Lucretia nursed him back to health at one point. He got very, very sick. And had it not been for her, he probably would have died. After that, he eventually became part of Andrew Jackson's kitchen cabinet, one of Andrew Jackson's closest advisors, and really turned on Henry Clay a great deal. Became quite the critic of Henry Clay, wrote in a newspaper in D.C. So Henry Clay became someone very much opposed to Henry Clay. And it's kind of sad in a way. I mean, you know, they had this relationship, and then he went this other direction. It would have been fine, I think, to be opposed to Henry Clay politically. A lot of people were, and that didn't bother him. He was quite fine for people to be opposed to him. But to take sort of the personal tack that he took, I think, was unfortunate.
Do you
Yes.
Henry's brother made furniture. Did Henry furnish that house with his brother's furniture? Or did you have any of it today?
So, yes, Henry Clay's brother, Porter, did make furniture for a little while, not for very long. It was a profession he enjoyed for maybe a decade. Then he went into other things. He was, I believe, state auditor. He held a state office for a while. And after that, underwent a religious conversion and became a Baptist minister, which was the profession he held for the majority of his life and what he was doing when he died. As far as the furniture in the house goes, yes, Henry Clay did buy furniture from his brother. The ledger I mentioned previously, where we have the thing about the waistcoats, also has an entry for Porter, and it lists all the furniture that Clay bought, and it was not an insubstantial amount. We unfortunately today do not have any pieces by Porter. That's something that I would hope maybe someday we'll be able to correct. The universe of Porter pieces is today in toto, I don't know, maybe 20 or 30 pieces. It is somewhat growing. There are some people now. We have a guy on our board who has become probably the world's leading authority on Porter and can readily identify the furniture based on looking at the universe that exists and extracting from it common characteristics. So hopefully someday we'll have a piece of Porter's furniture. It's very beautiful stuff. He was really a great cabinet maker in his time. Well, again, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate everybody coming out. If you'd like to learn more, obviously, Ashland is the place to do that. We've got lots more there on exhibit, lots more stories to tell. So thank you very much.